That's what I'd call a warm welcome. Thanks. Well, I hope you won't mind if I begin with a few truisms, which are important, I think, not because they're not obvious, they are, but because they're so commonly overlooked with often terrible human consequences. The first truism is that we're very fortunate to enjoy unusual, probably unique, freedom and privilege. And these benefits offer opportunity, and opportunity confers responsibility. Responsibility to use the opportunities that one enjoys wisely, honestly, and humanely. We cannot hope to do so unless we're willing to face simple truths, however uncomfortable they may be. So let me mention a few that should be on the front pages right now, in my opinion, in societies that value their freedom, but are kept under a veil of silence, not just here where they're of utmost significance, but in Western civilization generally. A few weeks ago, we should have commemorated the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, and shortly before that, the 15th anniversary of the murder of six leading Latin American intellectuals, Jesuit priests. These two events frame the hideous decade of the 1980s in Central America, where the U.S. waged or supported vicious terrorist wars directed in large part against the Latin American church, which had committed a grave crime. It had undertaken what the bishops called the preferential option for the poor, and the bishops were trying to revive the earliest centuries of the church, first three centuries of the church, when it was the church of the poor and the oppressed. All of that changed when the Emperor Constantine received his vision, as it's called, and converted to Christianity, and now quote a distinguished Oxford University theologian, he morphed the cross from being a hated symbol of Roman brutality into the universally recognizable logo of the Holy Roman Empire. Well, shortly after, still quoting, St. Augustine developed the novel idea of just war, trimming the church's originally pacifist message to the needs of the imperial war machine. And he does not fail to comment on the similarity to the vision of George W. Bush. Adopting liberation theology, priests, nuns, lay workers began reading the Gospels with poor peasants in the spirit of the first three centuries of the church, helping them to organize to escape from misery and bitter repression. Archbishop Romero was known as the voice for the voiceless, and the Jesuit intellectuals as well. And punishment was swift and terrible. The Archbishop and the Jesuits were assassinated by security forces armed and trained by Washington, in fact, by the current incumbents in Washington or their mentors. The truth commissions that finally surveyed the wreckage concluded that the same forces were also responsible for the vast majority of the other crimes in the region that included hundreds of thousands killed, horrifying torture, and every other imaginable atrocity. Archbishop Romero was assassinated while performing Mass shortly after he wrote to President Carter, pleading with him not to send aid to the military junta that ruled El Salvador because, I'm quoting, it will surely sharpen the repression that has been unleashed against the people's organizations fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights. He was assassinated. State terror escalated with decisive U.S. support and involvement throughout, and general Western silence and complicity. Actually, not complete silence. The famous School of the Americas which trains Latin American officers, including many involved in these atrocities, it takes a special pride that, I'm quoting its talking points, self-advertisement now, in that the U.S. Army helped defeat liberation theology. It's an interesting statement by the trainer of the Latin American military. And, of course, not silence in El Salvador, where Romero's anniversary was commemorated with reverence and no little despair. Or, for that matter, even in Boston, where I live, where there was at least one commemoration, maybe only one, in a church in a downtown neighborhood as a moving ceremony that I was privileged to be able to join, along with the widow of the leading human rights activist in El Salvador, who was imprisoned and tortured by U.S. clients, then assassinated, with the usual silence among the perpetrators, namely us. Throughout Central America, the story was much the same in those awful years. If anything remotely similar had happened in Eastern Europe, the events would be known and the anniversaries would have been commemorated, assuming, that is, that outrage had not led as far as nuclear war, which it might have. The differentiating principle is crystal clear. Our crimes do not exist. We must not remember the grim fate of those who were fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights in our own client terror states. And we must scrupulously evade our own primary responsibility for such crimes. That's probably close to a historical universal among the powerful. Actually, it's hardly unfamiliar right here. A few days before the anniversary of the Romero assassination, some at least commemorated the assassination, the anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie, another martyr in the cause of justice and peace. Killed by our hands, though we may prefer not to notice what we can very easily see. In Latin America, the traditional domain of U.S. power and control, the grim story is continuing. For example, in Colombia, which is the leading human rights violator in the hemisphere for many years, and also the leading recipient of U.S. military aid and training. That's incidentally a correlation that holds much more broadly. It's known to scholarship, but not to the general public. For some years, more trade union activists have been killed in Colombia than the rest of the world combined. Most of the atrocities are attributed to the military and the paramilitaries, who are so closely linked that the Human Rights Watch calls the paramilitaries a division of the Colombian army. A few weeks ago, the military broke into the most important of the towns that had declared itself a zone of peace, murdering many people, including women and children as young as two, also murdering the founder, who I happened to meet in Colombia recently. He was then pleading for international support for his community of peace. Was then under siege by the army and paramilitary, suffering severe hunger and state terror. No support came. The recent attack received scarcely a word in the press, illustrating once again that nonviolence is simply not permitted in client states. A few weeks ago, the United States, Washington, appointed its first director of intelligence services, John Negroponte. In the 1980s, he was the ambassador to Honduras, running the largest CIA station in the world. It's not because of the grand role of Honduras in the world scene. Rather, Negroponte's task was to supervise the military bases in Honduras for the CIA mercenary army that was attacking Nicaragua. And the secondary task was to deny vicious state terror which he knew all about, of course, and was authorizing in Honduras, so that Congress would not impede the flow of U.S. arms to the terrorist forces. If Nicaragua had adopted Western norms, it would have responded with terrorist atrocities in the United States in self-defense, in this case, legitimate self-defense. Instead, it followed the measures required by international law. It appealed to the World Court, which condemned Washington for unlawful use of force. It's a technical term which in lay terms means international terrorism, ordered the United States to terminate the crimes and to pay substantial reparations, which would more than cover the huge debt that is strangling Nicaragua as a result of the war. The court was dismissed with contempt. Washington then vetoed two Security Council resolutions affirming the court's judgment, and it proceeded to escalate the war, which was no small operation. The Nicaraguan death toll in per capita equivalent terms here would be 2.5 million dead in the United States. That's more than all deaths in all U.S. wars in history combined, including the Civil War. By now, 60% of young children suffer severe malnutrition, probable brain damage. To save them, no feeding tubes are needed. Just the very conservative but unthinkable process of obeying the law and paying what is owed. There's been virtually no reaction in the West, not just here, to the appointment of a condemned international terrorist to the top counterterrorism position in the world. I think Orwell wouldn't have known whether to laugh or to weep. It's unfortunately all too easy to continue, but I'll put that aside and turn to a more general question, the general question of the resort to force in international affairs and how its legitimacy has been understood over time. As you know, the unspeakable crimes of the 20th century led to dedicated efforts to save humans from the curse of war. Phrase of the opening words of the UN Charter. And the word save is no exaggeration. Surely, since it became clear in 1945 that the likelihood of ultimate doom is well beyond what any rational person should be willing to tolerate. Actually, the phrase ultimate doom is not mine, as a more interesting source. I'm borrowing it from two prominent strategic analysts, writing in the very sober and respectable Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, not given to hyperbole. They conclude that Washington's current programs, military programs, and aggressive stance, I'm quoting them, carry an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. And they urge the U.S. political system to acknowledge that the United States is the dominant threat to everyone else. They add that the terrifying technology now being developed in the what's called the transformation of the military will assuredly diffuse to the rest of the world, and the competition and intimidation led by Washington creates rising danger, potentially an unmanageable one, of course, for Americans as well. The authors express the hope that the threat that the United States government is posing to the world and to its own citizens will be countered by a coalition of peace-loving nations led by China. We've come to a pretty pass when such thoughts are expressed right at the heart of the establishment. And what that implies about the state of Western democracy, to which they don't appeal, is no less shocking. The appraisal by these analysts is by no means unusual. So in the current issue of Britain's leading Journal of International Affairs, former NATO planner Michael Maguire writes that under current policies, a nuclear exchange is ultimately inevitable. And like many others, McGuire concludes that the only hope for decent survival is the elimination of nuclear weapons in accord with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. And adherence to international law. Those are the two requirements. As for international law, he writes that, I'm quoting, there were many reasons for concluding before the event that the decision to wage war in Iraq was fundamentally flawed. But in the longer term, by far the most important was that the decision repudiated a century of slow, intermittent, and often painful progress towards an international system based on cooperative security, multilateral decision-making, collective action, agreed norms of behavior, and a steadily growing fabric of law. That's the thin fabric on which the hopes for survival precariously hang. In a few weeks, the five-year review conference of the NPT will take place. That's actually the subject of a current article by Thomas Graham. He's the former U.S. Special Representative for Arms Control, Disarmament, and Nonproliferation, and he's the author of a recent book on these topics published by University of Washington Press. He writes in this article that the NPT has never seemed weaker or the future less certain, and if the treaty should fail at the renewal in a couple of weeks, a nuclear nightmare world may become reality. Like other analysts, he recognizes that the primary threat to the NPT is U.S. government policy, though the other nuclear states share responsibility. The NPT was a compact in which the nuclear powers pledged to take good faith efforts to eliminate nuclear weapons. That's the crucial Article 6 of the NPT. And none of them have done so, and the United States is planning even more severe violations by developing new nuclear weapons, which will tear what's left of the treaty to shreds. The Bush administration alone announced that it no longer supports some of the Article 6 conclusions, the crucial ones for the nuclear states. The bargain was also based on a commitment to several additional treaties. One was the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was rejected by the Republican Senate in 1999 and declared off the agenda by Bush. Secondly, the ABM Treaty, which Bush rescinded. And most important, a verifiable fissile material cutoff treaty, FISBAN it's called, which would block terrible threat of adding, quoting Graham, adding more nuclear bomb material to the vast amount already existing. Last November, the UN Committee on Disarmament voted in favor of a verifiable FISBAN treaty. The vote was 147-1. A negative vote by the United States is, in effect, a veto. In fact, it's a double veto. Typically, it means that the resolution is blocked, and it's also barred from reporting and from history. I doubt if a tiny fraction of people here say ever heard of this. As far as I know, it was never reported. As had been predicted, one consequence of Washington's aggressive militarism was to drive Russia, and now probably China, to significant expansion of offensive capacities, just as a countermeasure. That's posing a very serious threat to the world, even a threat of accidental war, because the systems are on hair trigger alert. They're automated systems, and they regularly fail. We know that of our own systems, constantly failing. Theirs are much worse, you know, than far deteriorated and so on. A related and, in fact, very serious concern is that nuclear weapons may sooner or later fall into the hands of terrorist groups. Those grim prospects are also being enhanced by Bush administration aggressive militarism, quite consciously. None of this is secret. One consequence is that Russia is continually transferring nuclear weapons across its vast territory to counter mounting U.S. threats. Prominent strategic analysts point out that terrorists may steal such weapons, which could spell disaster to an American city, I'm quoting, and still worse, the seizure of a ready-to-fire strategic missile capable of delivering bombs to targets thousands of miles away could be apocalyptic for entire nations. That's Bruce Blair, the head of the Center for Defense Information in the Washington Post. These dangers are being consciously escalated by the threat and use of violence, which, as was widely predicted, is stimulating nuclear proliferation, along with the jihadi terrorism that traces back to Reagan administration programs to organize, arm, and train radical Islamists, not for the defense of Afghanistan, as was proclaimed, but for much more ugly and familiar reasons of state. Well, that much is, or at least should be, familiar, but less well known is the tolerance of the present incumbents in Washington in their Reaganite phase, their tolerance for Pakistan's slide towards radical Islamist extremism under the rule of one of the many brutal dictators they supported. Saddam was not the only one. Another in Pakistan was Zia-ul-Huq, and also as a result of their willingness to look away while their ally was developing nuclear weapons. Reagan annually endorsed the pretense that Pakistan was not developing them, though U.S. intelligence knew perfectly well that they were, and his successors paid little attention, while Pakistan's leading proliferator, now tapped on the wrist, was carrying out what appears to be the most extraordinary nuclear smuggling enterprise ever. The invasion of Iraq is another case in point. It was undertaken with the expectation that it would probably increase the threat of terror. Among many others, that was predicted by U.S. intelligence agencies in their report to the president a few weeks before the invasion. And the predictions came true, as now confirmed by intelligence agencies and strategic analysts. The conclusions are also confirmed by U.S. intelligence. Its most recent analysis, a couple of months ago, concludes that the invasion of Iraq created a new training area for professional terrorists who will disperse throughout the world, replacing the Afghan havens that were established at first by the Reagan administration and its British and Pakistani allies. The official reason for the invasion of Iraq was that it was developing weapons of mass destruction, and the U.S. and Britain therefore proclaimed the right to invade in what was called anticipatory self-defense. That was what they called the single question that was stressed constantly by Bush, Blair, Powell, and other high officials, the single question. As is now conceded, there weren't any weapons of mass destruction, apart from what had been produced in the 1980s, thanks to aid provided by the U.S. and Britain, along with others, which continued long after Saddam Hussein's worst atrocities and long after the end of the war with Iran. After the invasion, the U.S. invasion, U.S.-British invasion in 2003, there was sophisticated, massive looting of the installations that were constructed in the 1980s. That includes high-precision equipment capable of making parts for nuclear and chemical weapons and missiles, and also toxins for biological weapons. Prior to the U.S.-British invasion, these sites had been monitored by U.N. inspectors, but they were quickly kicked out of the country and have not been back since, while the occupation forces left the sites unguarded. And very sophisticated looting operations took place. Where this huge mass of equipment has gone, no one knows, and it's uncomfortable to guess. The ironies are almost inexpressible. The U.S. and Britain invaded to prevent the use of weapons of mass destruction that did not exist and they succeeded in providing the terrorists that they had mobilized with the means to develop weapons of mass destruction that the U.S. and Britain had provided to Saddam Hussein. I mean, the fact that those are not major headlines in every day's newspaper is mind-boggling. Well, there are many other examples of the willingness of top planners to risk international terrorism, which by now can have awesome consequences, as they know well. It's not, of course, that they welcome terrorism. Rather, it's simply that it's just not a high priority in comparison with other objectives, such as controlling the world's major energy resources, which is in the Middle East, which are to become even more significant soon. Exxon Mobil, a major oil company, which has been pretty conservative about this, recently published a 30-year expectations for the next 30 years. And for the first time ever, they've mentioned peak oil, you know, when it could come. And they make the astonishing prediction that within 5 years, the non-OPEC countries will reach the peak of oil production. After that, it begins to decline. And the only hope that they see for more oil is sharply increased production in the OPEC countries, which means primarily the Persian Gulf. So the need to control, not necessarily access, but to control this oil is extraordinary importance. One of the more astute of the senior planners and analysts, Zbigniew Brzezinski, recently pointed out that control of Iraq gives the United States what he calls critical leverage over its European and Asian rivals, the real enemies. He was reiterating conclusions of leading planners after World War II who recognized that control over what they called the stupendous source of strategic power in the Gulf region, that control of it would give the United States veto power over its industrial rivals. That's George Kennan in this case. It's a rational calculation on the assumption that human survival is not particularly significant in comparison with power and wealth. And that's nothing new. That's a theme that resonates through history. The difference is today is only that the stakes are enormously higher. I mean, they really are survival. In 1945, the efforts to end the curse of war led to a consensus on the principles that should guide state action that's formalized in the UN Charter. That consensus was reiterated last December by a high-level UN panel, which included the National Security Advisor for George Bush I, Brent Scowcroft. The panel reaffirmed the conditions of the Charter, that force can be deployed only when authorized by the Security Council or in defense against armed attack until the Security Council acts. Any other resort to force is a war crime. In fact, the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. That's the quoting from the judgment of the Nuremberg Tribunal. The December 2004 panel concluded that these conditions, in their words, should be neither rewritten nor reinterpreted. The panel then adds an important comment. It says, for those impatient with such a response, the answer must be that in a world full of perceived potential threats, the risk to global order and the norm of non-intervention on which it continues to be based is simply too great for the legality of unilateral preventive action as distinct from collectively endorsed action to be accepted. Allowing one to so act is to allow all. That last sentence is important. It presupposes a principle that's the foundation of every moral code that merits even the slightest attention, namely the principle of universality. We apply to ourselves the same standards we do to others, if we're serious, more stringent ones. But that principle is flatly rejected in the intellectual, moral, political culture of the most powerful states, which again raises the prospects of ultimate doom. Actually, that comment by the UN panel was responding very directly to several years of enthusiastic support by Western intellectuals for the resort to force by their own states on alleged humanitarian grounds. That's another very familiar theme throughout history, including the worst monsters. In the last Hitler, for example, very humanitarian if you look at the rhetoric. In the last years of the last millennium, across the spectrum of elite opinion in the West, there was a claim for, quoting now, for the idealistic new world bent on ending inhumanity, which had entered a noble phase of its foreign policy with a saintly glow. For the first time in history, a state is dedicated to principles and values, acting from altruism and moral fervor alone as the leader of the enlightened states, hence free to resort to force for what its leaders determine to be right. And that's a tiny sample of an extraordinary deluge, drawn in this case only from the most respected liberal voices, and in my opinion one of the most embarrassing moments of intellectual history, which is not a very elevated history. These declarations reflect elite perceptions, but not those of the general public. It's important to know that a large majority of the American public continue to take the position expressed in the UN Charter, namely the position that states are entitled to use force only if, I'm quoting from the polls now, only if there is strong evidence that the country is in imminent danger of being attacked. So a large majority of the public reject the bipartisan consensus on what's called preemptive war and agree with the recent UN panel and incidentally agree with the what used to be called the non-aligned movement, the governments of 80% of the world's population who have forcefully issued similar declarations, but they're of course ignored or dismissed with derision. What do they matter? The legitimacy of the use of force is not the only issue on which the public opinion in the United States diverges sharply from elite political culture. So to take another current example, which also raises issues of survival, you commonly read, you read many times, that the U.S. Refused to join the Kyoto Treaty a month ago. That's only true if the phrase United States excludes its population, who overwhelmingly... the population overwhelmingly support ratification of the treaty. In fact, support it so enthusiastically that a majority of Bush voters believe that he agreed with them that the U.S. should join the treaty because it's so obvious. Large majorities also believe that the U.S. should accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and the World Court, should rely on the United Nations to take the lead in international crises. That happens to include issues of security, reconstruction, and political transition in Iraq. Most of the population even believe that the U.S. should abandon the Security Council veto, which is quite a surprising result. In other words, accept majority rule, even if the U.S. is opposed. Actually, the same is true on a host of other issues. So large majorities believe that the U.S. should rely on diplomatic and economic measures more than military ones in the so-called war on terror, and overwhelming majorities, as in the past, favor increased government spending on health care, education, and other social spending. Needless to say, all of this is in sharp opposition to the bipartisan consensus. Studies revealing these facts were released by the most prestigious institutions that monitor public attitudes shortly before the November presidential elections. Studies were carried out and released in time for the elections. Well, plainly, they're of critical importance for functioning democracy. What the studies reveal is that both political parties are far to the right of the population on many of the most crucial issues. They were scarcely reported, barely a word. And those observations, unfortunately, generalize. That lends further weight to the judgment of the strategic analysts I quoted earlier about the state of Western democracy. In Europe, they weren't reported at all. The crisis they see as so serious that we should turn to China to rescue us from disaster. Washington's unilateral right to resort to force was articulated publicly by the Bush administration in its national security strategy of September 2002. However, that broke no new ground. Even before the year 2000 election, Condoleezza Rice wrote an article in Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal, in which she condemned what she called the reflexive appeal to notions of international law and norms and the belief that the support of many states, or even better, of institutions like the United Nations, is essential to the legitimate exercise of power. By the United States, of course, the usual exception prevails. Rice's dismissal of international law and norms is reiterated in the National Defense Strategy, which was just released, which declares, I'm quoting it, that our strength as a nation state will continue to be challenged by those who employ a strategy of the weak, using international forums, judicial processes, and terrorism. Okay, so international law and other peaceful means are a dangerous challenge to the U.S. freedom to resort to violence at will. It might be useful, if not particularly pleasant, to search for precedents for these widely held views among educated elites, that is, public disagrees, but it's kept silent. Well, at the margins, you do find more nuanced opinions on the resort to force. One of the most important of them is the International Independent Commission of Inquiry on the Kosovo War, which was headed by a distinguished South African jurist, Justice Richard Goldstone. The commission concluded that the NATO bombing of Serbia was, in their words, illegal but legitimate. It was, they recognized, in gross violation of the fundamental principles of international law, but I'm now quoting, it was legitimate because all diplomatic avenues had been exhausted, and there was no other way to stop the killing and atrocities in Kosovo. Justice Goldstone, who headed it, concluded that the UN Charter may need revision in the light of the report of the commission that he headed because the NATO bombing is too important a precedent to be disregarded. I mean, as distinct, say, from Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, which isn't a precedent. Depends who carries it out, as always. Notice that his conclusion is the conclusion that was explicitly rejected by the UN panel that reviewed this and other cases last December. Goldstone also stressed the need for objective analysis, which is good advice. So let's try some of that. One question that objective analysis might address is whether indeed it is true that all diplomatic options had been exhausted in Kosovo. When NATO decided to bomb, there were two diplomatic options on the table. There was a NATO proposal and a Serbian proposal. After 78 days of bombing, a compromise was reached between them, though NATO instantly violated it. Fanatics on all sides know whether diplomatic options were available. But those of us who are restricted to evidence can only conclude that there may well have been diplomatic options, so it appears. A second question is whether, again, there was no other way to stop the killings and atrocities in Kosovo, as the Independent Commission asserts, clearly a very crucial matter. Those of you, I'm sure you recall that at that time, March 1999, it was constantly described as genocide right before the bombing, hundreds of reports in the media at the time, and that continues until today, including, incidentally, current scholarship. So it was genocide. Was there any other way to stop it? Well, here, objective analysis happens to be unusually easy. There is a vast documentary record from impeccable Western sources. The State Department published two major collections of documents seeking to justify the bombing. British parliamentary inquiry issued an extensive report of it. There was massive evidence from NATO, from the OSCE, the monitors, and many others. And they all reached the same conclusion. Overwhelmingly, the killings and atrocities followed the bombing. In the extensive literature on the topic, from media to scholarship, the documentation is almost universally ignored. Interesting experiment to take a look and see. It's there, but it's ignored. And worse, the chronology is reversed, so that the bombing is presented as a reaction to the atrocities, as in the Independent Commission report, although unquestionably it's the other way around, at least if we can believe the State Department, the British Parliament, NATO, and others. There's an extensive literature on this in media and scholarship. I've reviewed it, and I won't, in print, I will put that dismal record aside, but it's a very revealing one about the nature of the moral and intellectual culture in which we live. We're not talking about some, remote tribe in New Guinea that we don't understand. We're talking about ourselves. Well, the consequences of the bombing came as no surprise. They were predicted at once by NATO Commander General Wesley Clark, quite publicly, when the bombing began, predicted, yes, going to lead to massive atrocities. The Clinton administration also anticipated the crimes that followed the bombing. We knew that at the time, and it's confirmed in much more detail in General Clark's memoirs. Kosovo was, and in fact, if you look at the Milosevic indictment, which was issued right in the middle of the bombing, it's for crimes after the bombing. There's actually one exception. A couple of months earlier, but the entire indictment is based on crimes after the bombing. It's amazing to be able to conceal this. I mean, the facts are just not even remotely in question. Well, Kosovo was, in fact, an ugly place before the NATO bombing. That was March 1999. Regrettably, it was not a particularly ugly place by international standards. According to the major Western sources, as I mentioned, about 2,000 people were killed in the year prior to the invasion. That's when it became an international issue. Many of them were killed by KLA guerrillas, Albanian guerrillas, attacking Serbs from Albania in an effort, as they openly announced, in an effort to elicit a harsh Serbian response that could rally Western opinion to their cause. The British government, which is the most hawkish element of the alliance, they make the astonishing claim that until January 1999, most of the killings were the responsibility of the KLA guerrillas attacking from Albania. And the rich Western documentation reveals that nothing substantial changed until the NATO bombing 2 months later. When this claim first came out, I assumed that they don't mean it because it seems so impossible, but it's now reiterated in the British Parliamentary Inquiry Report, so evidently that is their position. It's also the there's one scholarly study, serious one, that even considers these matters seriously. It's a careful and judicious study by a British scholar, Nicholas Wheeler. He estimates that Serbs were responsible for 500 of the 2,000 people killed. He supports the NATO bombing on the grounds that there would have been worse atrocities if NATO had not bombed. So the argument is that by bombing at a time when most of the atrocities were attributed to the KLA guerrillas, with the anticipation that the bombing would lead to far worse atrocities, NATO was preventing atrocities. The fact that this is the strongest argument that can be contrived by serious analysts, and I stress serious because there's plenty of nonsense, that tells us a good deal about the decision to bomb, particularly when we recall that there apparently were diplomatic options. Well, Kosovo is worth keeping in mind because that's one of the two great achievements that's brought forth to give retrospective proof that for the first time in history, states are observing principles and values under the guidance of their Anglo-American tutors, and that the UN Charter has to be revised to allow the West to carry out what it calls humanitarian intervention. The other example that's brought up is East Timor. That example is truly atrocious. The fact that it can even be brought up without shame is a remarkable comment on Western intellectual culture. And here, almost the entire West is complicit, though the U.S.-British role is by far the worst. That's extensively discussed in print, too, so I'll skip it. It ought to be well known. And I'll skip some other examples that merit discussion and I think lead to essentially the same conclusion. Well, there's one case that can't be ignored. That's the Bush-Blair invasion of Iraq, justified solely by Iraq's refusal to obey Security Council orders to stop developing weapons of mass destruction, as Washington and London constantly stressed. Well, as you know, after the collapse of these pretexts, we were informed that the justification was not anticipatory self-defense, as had been solemnly proclaimed, but rather it was what the liberal press calls Bush's messianic vision to bring democracy to the world. It's the way the new version was described without irony. Presidents prior to Bush had principles and doctrines and so on, but Bush only has visions. If you read, it's interesting to read the media commentary on it. It's all they had. His first person to have visions all the time. I suspect that the reason why the PR operatives do this is because of his father was criticized for lacking what was called the vision thing. So he's going to have plenty of visions, you know, and there are sometimes you see half a dozen references in the same article. It's worth interesting journalistic convention. Well, the reaction to Bush's messianic vision after the pretext collapsed was quite interesting. I reviewed it pretty extensively. There was a range. It ranged from rapturous awe to critical commentary, which praised the nobility and generosity of the vision, but warned that it may be beyond our means. The beneficiaries are too backward. It might prove too costly. That this was the guiding vision is presupposed throughout as self-evident, so you don't have to give any evidence for it, it just is. Actually, it's hard to find an exception within the mainstream. You might try. All that was missing was evidence. So apparently the declarations of the leadership suffice, and a mass of counter-evidence up to the present can be dismissed as irrelevant, very much as in the, say, in the manner of North Korea, for example, which would react the same way if the dear leader produced a messianic vision. Actually, there was one exception to this, I have to admit. In the coverage in the United States, there was one exception to the rapture over the vision and so on. It was published in the Washington Post a couple of days after Bush announced his messianic vision with great pomp in Washington and great acclaim. The Post did report a poll taken in Iraq where people were in Baghdad were asked why they thought the U.S. invaded. And some agreed with 100% of Western opinion, 1%. 1% said the goal was to bring democracy. The rest said what's kind of obvious. The U.S. invaded, U.S. and Britain invaded to take control of Iraq's resources. Reactions were much more subtle and nuanced if you look closely. 50% of the same people said the U.S. wants democracy, which sounds like a contradiction since 1% said that its goal was democracy, but it's not a contradiction because those backward people are not so as ignorant as of American history as we are. What they said is, the 50% said the U.S. wants democracy, but it's not going to allow the Iraq to exercise it. So it wants a kind of democracy in which the U.S. will control it, you know, which is plenty of historical evidence for that. And they're probably relying on their own history because that's what Britain had done for, you know, half a century. So the backward people are not always as stupid as we claim. There should be some, you know, witnesses for the defense of the messianic vision. And the strongest witnesses should be the leading scholars and the most enthusiastic advocates of what's called democracy promotion. Actually, the most prominent among them is the director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment, Thomas Carruthers, who's a good, careful scholar. He's just published a helpful book on the topic, reviewing the record of democracy promotion since the end of the Cold War. Remember, he's a strong enthusiast. He finds what he calls a strong line of continuity running through all administrations, I'm quoting, where democracy appears to fit in well with U.S. security and economic interests, the United States promotes democracy. Where democracy clashes with significant interests, it's downplayed or ignored. In fact, actually eliminated, but don't say that. He says all administrations are schizophrenic in this regard, some kind of psychic malady, need some psychiatrist, and they're schizophrenic with curious consistency. Okay. He doesn't draw any conclusions from it, but he does predict with regret that Iraq policies will likely exhibit similar contradictions between stated principles and political reality, more schizophrenia. Well, it did not take long for his predictions to be fulfilled. The occupation authorities worked very hard to prevent the threat of democracy, but they were compelled with great reluctance to permit elections. That's a major triumph of nonviolent resistance. The U.S. doesn't care that much about suicide bombers in the arena of violence. It prevails overwhelmingly. But the mass nonviolent resistance simply could not be ignored. And it forced elections. The Ayatollah Sistani is a kind of a symbol of it. There are very few competent observers who would disagree with the editors of the world's leading business daily, the London Financial Times, who wrote that after the elections that the reason the elections took place was the insistence of the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who vetoed three schemes by the U.S.-led occupation authorities to shelve or dilute elections. Of course, he couldn't do it alone. It's because there was mass popular nonviolent resistance, demonstrations, and so on, that the U.S. and Britain couldn't resist. That's a major triumph of nonviolent resistance and should be understood that way. Once the elections had to take place, the U.S. took credit for them, but that's normal. After failing to block the elections, Bush and Blair literally did not waste one moment in declaring that they intended to subvert them. Both Bush and Blair announced right away that there would be no timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops. Both governments are well aware that according to their own polls, an overwhelming majority of Iraqis want the occupying forces withdrawn from their territories. In fact, want them so strongly that even the U.S. candidate, Iyad Alawi, had to join his competitors by including this as a plank in his electoral program. Similar conflicts persist over Iraqi resistance to the efforts by the occupying forces, the Bremer occupation administration, to impose economic arrangements which essentially open up the economy to take over by foreign corporations, mainly U.S. and British. So the strong line of continuity persists, exactly as Carruthers predicted it would, regretfully. Carruthers also happens to have written the standard scholarly work on democracy promotion in Latin America in the 1980s. This is in part from an insider's perspective. He was serving in Reagan's State Department in the programs that were called Democracy Enhancement. And so he's writing both as an insider and a scholar. He regards the Reagan programs as sincere, although he says a failure, and an oddly systematic failure. As he points out, where U.S. influence was least, namely in the Southern Cone and South America, progress towards democracy was greatest. And where U.S. influence was greatest, namely the regions nearby, progress was least. And he even gives the reason. The reason, he says, is that the U.S. would tolerate, I'm quoting, only limited top-down forms of democratic change that did not risk upsetting the traditional structures of power with which the United States has long been allied in fundamentally undemocratic countries. Washington sought to maintain the basic order of quite undemocratic societies and avoid populist-based change. So in short, the strong line of continuity goes back a decade earlier to its Reaganite roots. I should mention that he regards himself as a neo-Reaganite. In fact, the strong line of continuity goes back far before. Democracy promotion has always been proclaimed as a guiding vision, but it's not even controversial that the U.S. regularly overthrew democratic governments, often installing or supporting brutal tyrannies. This consistent practice is not denied. It's too obvious to deny, but it's usually explained away as somehow in terms of Cold War imperatives, which in fact had very little relevance, often none, as you discover when you investigate case by case. What we do find, however, is the same strong line of continuity. Democracy is a good thing if and only if it is consistent with strategic and economic interests. Well, none of this should elicit any surprise. The record, consistent and rich record, really merely reveals that the United States is very much like other powerful states, past and present. It pursues the strategic and economic interests of dominant internal sectors. Democracy is fine as long as it takes the top-down form that does not risk popular interference with the primary interests of power and wealth. Incidentally, there's no time to go into it, but the same is true if you look carefully of the what are called the great achievements in Europe and Japan after the Second World War. It was very much the same if you look well known in scholarship. And much the same doctrine holds internally, where enormous efforts are made, quoting now, to protect the minority of the opulent from the majority, quoting James Madison, who informed his colleagues that that's a primary goal of government. He was, of course, the framer of the American constitutional system. That's what he explained to them at the Constitutional Convention. And that's the way the country was set up, to protect the minority of the opulent from the majority. Well, over the centuries, popular struggles have chipped away at that and gained many victories for freedom and democracy. But progress does not follow a smooth upward trajectory. We see that today. one of the repeated periods of regression. And we see it quite visibly in the United States, but increasingly in Europe as well, and in part, large part, for quite similar underlying reasons. Well, to finish up, I mentioned a small sample of cases of major significance for the future. Ranking high among them is the propriety of the use of force. Careful inquiry might unearth genuine cases of intervention that are illegal but legitimate, but there's always a heavy burden of proof. The prize example that's offered, namely Kosovo, tends to reinforce the measured judgment of the World Court in 1949, which they reaffirmed in the Nicaragua case and others, and which was recently reiterated by the UN panel, high-level UN panel, last December. The court in 1949 concluded that the court can only regard the alleged right of intervention as the manifestation of a policy of force, such as has in the past given rise to most serious abuses, and such as cannot, whatever be the defects in international organization, find a place in international law. From the nature of things, intervention would be reserved for the more powerful, most powerful states, and might easily lead to perverting the administration of justice itself. That's a judicious understatement, as they knew. Inquiry does very definitely reveal that state terror and other forms of threat and use of force have brought the world very close to the edge of ultimate doom, shockingly so. Today, surely only the most blind and irrational will ignore the call that was issued by Bertrand Russell and Alfred Einstein exactly 50 years ago. They said, here then is the problem which we present to you, stark and dreadful and inescapable. Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war? Thanks.
There's a question or two, okay. if I may. And what I'd like to ask is, based on my sense of at least three really big themes in your talk tonight and indeed your work in general. One is the incredible and somewhat systematic disconnection between the preferences of majorities of the people in this country and the policies and actions of the elites who apparently are running the country. A second theme is that disconnection tends to seldom make the headlines. That what does make the headlines are the policies and actions and the quibbles and sometimes squabbles among the elites. And the third theme, which seems to me crucial as I grasp this overview of the world, is that the policies that come out of these two elements of our democracy are greatly dysfunctional. It is not that the elites are wiser than the people and therefore must make these decisions on their behalf. It is that they're making decisions in isolation from the intelligence of the people in the democracy that is designed to make the public intelligence available to elites when they decide. And so the results are less than desirable. So my question is, turning back to your linguist side, is this a deep grammar of empire? Is this a deep grammar that all empires follow? And if so, where is the potential in here to seize back control of democracy and make better choices?
Well, of your three points, I actually agree with two. There is a consistent disconnect. You find this all the time. Right now, it has to be extremely dramatic. And secondly, yes, it not only doesn't make the headlines, it rarely even gets reported. In fact, the extent to which it is unknown is just dramatic. I mean, the fact that these major studies right before the election were barely reported, they were even mentioned in the national press, that's pretty striking. And it, I'm sure, reflects editorial awareness that you better not let people know what public opinion is. It's hard to think of any other reason. In fact, sometimes it's shockingly dramatic. Like you'll remember, I'm sure, that a year ago, in March 2004, Spain voted out the government. The reaction here was kind of interesting. The Aznar government was hailed, you know, as the leading hope for democracy in the future. They were the leader of so-called New Europe. You know. In fact, Aznar was allowed to join Blair and Bush at the summit announcing the war. Aznar had gone to war with the support of 2% of the Spanish population. So therefore, he was the hope for democracy in the future. That's one of the things we're supposed to disregard when we talk about the messianic vision. Last March, he was voted out of office, and Spain was bitterly condemned for appeasing terrorists and so on and so forth. Actually, what the Spanish voters voted for was to keep, not what was claimed, they didn't vote to pull UN troops out of Iraq, they voted to pull U.S. Spanish troops out of Iraq unless they were under UN control, which happened to be the opinion of 70% of the American population at the time. There's two crucial differences between Spain and the United States, and I'm certainly not claiming that Spain is an exemplary democracy, anything but. But two differences were that in Spain, voters knew that that was public opinion. In the United States, the only way to find out is to do an individual research project, which nobody has time for. And in Spain, they could vote on it. Here we can't, like it's totally remote from either political party program or from the media. Now, those are important things to consider. And it's not the only case. Now, the one thing on which I don't agree with you completely is that the policies are dysfunctional. It depends for who. It seems to me the policies typically are, sometimes leadership makes mistakes, undoubtedly. Like you look at history, like around half the wars are lost by the ones who started them. Okay, so that was dysfunctional. But it doesn't mean it was an irrational choice, maybe they thought they had a good chance to win. But the policies of the Bush administration are, in fact, fairly consistently U.S. policies, including Vietnam and many other cases. I think those policies were highly functional. Not always, but quite functional for those who made the decisions and the interests that they represent. For them, it worked. For the population, it didn't work. But that's normal. Like if you take, say, the British Empire over a couple of centuries, this is kind of a hard calculation to carry out, but there have been studies that tried to do a sort of cost-benefit analysis of the empire. How much did they gain by it? Well, the results are, they're not precise, but can't be. But the rough conclusion is that the costs and the benefits were approximately the same. So why have an empire? Well, you get the answer if you look at how the costs and the benefits were distributed within England. There's a sharp difference. So the financiers and the investors and so on, for them it was fantastic. For the British sailors who were being, dragooned into the Navy and, killed and so on and so forth, and the poor people paying the taxes, it was a loss. So the empire was, it's class war, basically, internal to the imperial society. And that's pretty standard. I think that's the case here, too. The policies are functional for the leadership, dysfunctional for the population, but that's pretty normal. Their job isn't to do things that are helpful to the population. Of course, that's the rhetoric, but, that's Hitler's and Stalin's rhetoric, too. That's everybody's rhetoric. Doesn't tell you anything. It's uninformative. You don't pay any attention to that rhetoric if you're sane, because it's uninformative. It's universal, so it doesn't say anything. But if you look at the actual consequences, they're quite systematic. In fact, you can just about predict Bush administration policies, and I don't want to suggest they're so different from anyone else, but they are at an extreme. You can predict the policies by a very simple measure, almost perfectly. Does it help the rich and powerful? If it does, that's going to be the policy. Does it harm the general population? it's kind of irrelevant. Most of the time it does. But it's just not a consideration. Try to find a counterexample to that, you know, in domestic policy or international policy. It's very hard. That very elementary principle accounts for an awful lot, which gets to your question. Is there some kind of fundamental, you know, deep structure of empire? I don't think so. My feeling is that in human affairs, our understanding is so superficial that anything that's known is right on the surface. I mean, part of the task of intellectuals is to make simple things sound complicated. You know, so it's put in, otherwise, you know, you don't have professional credentials and so on. So, you know, there are all kind of what are called theories and so on and so forth, polysyllabic words and so on. When you take it all apart, it's pretty much common sense. And it's not because people are incompetent. It's just too hard. You know, we don't understand enough about human beings, whether it's family or international affairs, to say anything that isn't pretty obvious to inspection. So, you know, if you think about it and you work and so on, you can sort of figure out what's going on. This standard principle that decisions made by the powerful tend to be in the interest of those they represent and the rest are irrelevant, I mean, that's pretty close to a universal, and you don't need anything profound to understand it. I mean, what else do you expect in a system of domination and hierarchy? I mean, and that holds from, you know, patriarchal families up to slave societies and empires. It's basically the same principle, and pretty much we'd expect. So what's the answer? Eliminate hierarchy and domination. There's no other answer. That was more, you know, it's an answer that we all know and that people have always known. I mean, that's why we have progress, when people act on what they know. And fortunately, they often do. And for us, it happens to be unusually easy because we have a legacy of freedom, which was won by struggle. It was not granted by any higher authority. It's always won, but then it's there. And you can use it to go on or you can abandon it and give up. That's the choice.
Well, I'm afraid that eliminating hierarchy and domination would put political scientists out of business. We would have very little to study.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, there are a range of questions, as you might imagine. Why don't we look through them together here and see which ones you
would
be...
I'll use your judgment.
Well, okay.
Otherwise, I'll sound biased.
Here's a good one. I am nearly convinced that Kosovo and East Timor were ultimately failures and violations of peaceful pursuits. Could you also deconstruct the best example of an illegal, successful intervention?
Which one?
Pick your favorite one.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't think they were failures. I think they were successes. In the case of Kosovo, Serbia was a pain in the neck for the United States. Milosevic is a tyrant, there's no doubt of it, but not a particularly terrible tyrant. You know, by regular, like the, if you measure him against the kind of people the U.S. was supporting all those years, like Ceausescu and Suharto and so on, he looks like kind of a Boy Scout. But yeah, he was pretty awful. But he was independent, you know. They were not following orders. I mean, it was the one corner of Europe that was not pretty much under control. And in fact, if you look at the actual reasons given for the war, not the, you know, rhetoric for the public, but the internal discussion, which we know, it's a pretty free country, we know what they said. The main reason given by both Clinton and Blair was we have to bomb to preserve the credibility of NATO. Okay, when they talk about NATO, they're not talking about Italy and Norway, right? They're talking about the credibility of the United States. Now, what does it mean to preserve the credibility of the United States? Well, just, you know, again, you don't need any deep theories. All you have to do is go ask your favorite mafia don. He'll explain it to you. If you're the mafia don and somebody doesn't follow orders, you don't let them get away with it because you got to maintain your credibility. You got to make it clear that you follow orders. So if some, you know, guy who runs a small grocery store doesn't pay his protection money, you don't just send your goons in to collect the money. You make an example of them. You beat them to a pulp. You know, you kill them or something. That establishes credibility. And international affairs is remarkably like the mafia. You have to maintain credibility. And in fact, if you look through the internal documentary record, which we are an unusually free country, unique, in fact. So we have an unusually rich record of internal planning. I mean, luckily, nobody looks at it. But if you look at it, it's very illuminating. So take, say, Cuba, which the United States has been attacking now for 45 years. You know, major international terrorist attacks, one of them almost led to a terminal nuclear war, economic warfare, and so on. What's it for? Well, you look at the documents, you find out. Back in the early 60s, you know, Kennedy-Johnson administrations, they were concerned that what they said, the very existence of the Castro regime is successful defiance of U.S. policies going back to the 1820s. You know, nothing about the Russians. They're talking about the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine said, we're going to run this hemisphere. Okay? Couldn't do it for a long time. The British were too powerful, you know, and so on and so forth. But that was the goal back to the 1820s. And the very existence of the Castro regime is successful defiance of this 150-year-old policy. Well, you know, Mafia Don can't take that. You don't allow successful defiance. It doesn't matter if there's any point to it or anything else. Actually, pretty much the same is going on with Iran right now. The regional countries, Iraq, Kuwait, all of them, I mean, they don't like Iran particularly, but they want to reintegrate it into the regional system. They'd rather have friends than enemies. Europe's in favor of it. Asia's in favor of it. Interestingly, American oil companies are in favor of it. They'd like to get back in Iran. They don't like the fact that they're cut out. But there's a state interest in preserving credibility. They did something wrong. They threw out the vicious, murderous tyranny that we installed when we destroyed their parliamentary regime. And that's a crime that cannot be permitted. Okay, so therefore, no matter who wants anything, we're going to go after them. They're very similar to Cuba, except far more important. But this is a pretty standard principle of international affairs. You've got to preserve credibility. Well, they did. You know, they smashed up Serbia. Okay. Established credibility. So I don't think that was a failure. What about East Timor? Well, you know, that's a horrendous case. This is probably the closest thing to genocide in the latter part of the 20th century. Started in 1975 when Indonesia invaded with U.S. support. The great liberal hero, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, was then UN ambassador. And he explained in his memoirs what happened. This isn't a secret document. This is his memoirs that came out in 1978. He said, my role at the United Nations was to render the UN utterly ineffective in any actions it might take to end the Indonesian aggression and withdraw the troops. That's the most important thing he ever did in his life. And he knew what the effects were. He says, follows that by saying that within a couple of weeks, apparently about 60,000 people were killed. Later was a third of the population. And he then goes off to some other topic. You know, who cares? So, yeah, great thing I did. I rendered the UN utterly ineffective by preventing them from stopping the aggression, which they could have done. And that's why he's a liberal hero. Which he is. You know, he's upheld as a great exponent of international law and so on and so forth. The U.S. immediately sent arms for the aggression. Carter administration continued to do so. The really near genocide peaked in 1978, so did U.S. arms. The British joined in at that point. That was the Labor Party. And, you know, because Indonesia is a rich, you know, a lot of rich resources, you know, you want to exploit Indonesian resources, so they happily sold arms to slaughter Timorese. It got worse through the 80s. with the Reagan administration and the Thatcher administration doing it. It went on right through 1999. And if you look at the record, it went on through September 1999. Britain and the United States were still supporting the aggression. This is after that final paroxysm of violence where Indonesia practically wiped the place out. And by then it was being reported. Most of the time it was being suppressed. But September 1999 got so awful they started reporting it. Clinton was still saying, no, it's an Indonesian problem, we're not going to get involved. Britain was still sending arms. That's Robin Cook's ethical foreign policy, it was called. Finally, domestic pressure got so significant, and international pressure, mainly from Australia, was so strong that Clinton was compelled to inform Indonesia, the Indonesian generals, that they have to withdraw, which they did instantly. Now, there's a lesson there. That tells you that the United States, for 25 years, could have stopped the massive slaughter, no intervention necessary, just by telling the Indonesian generals, call it off. Try to find somebody who drew that lesson. I mean, it is just crystal clear. So, you know, here's a case where the U.S. primarily and Britain secondarily and everybody else came in too at some level, were happy to be involved in one of the worst genocidal operations of the late 20th century as long as they could make plenty of money out of it and as long as the media would keep it silent, which they did and reported. Barely, you know. Is that successful? Yeah. I mean, they kept their relations with Indonesia, you know, worked fine. You know, it wasn't very successful for the Timorese, but you know, who cares about them? What's a paradigm case of really, you know, intervention, the humanitarian intervention you could justify? It's pretty hard to find cases. I mean, there are a few in the last half century that you can maybe justify. Actually, the two most significant ones are interesting. They're both in the 1970s. So it's kind of interesting that the 1990s are called the period when the new norm of international intervention was established. And the reason is because it was the West that was carrying out what it claimed to be humanitarian interventions. But take the 70s. Well, then there really were cases that maybe qualify. Now, the first one was 1971, when India invaded what was then East Pakistan and did stop horrendous massacres of millions of people in what's now Bangladesh. That was 71. The other was 1979, December 78, when Vietnam invaded Cambodia, drove out the Khmer Rouge, right at the point when their atrocities were peaking. Before that, it was bad enough, but the horrible stuff was going on in late 78. I mean, that's where the piles of skulls and Tuol Sleng and all that business is. Right at that point, Vietnam invaded, kicked out the Khmer Rouge. Well, those were both illegal interventions, but I think you can make a case that they were justified humanitarian interventions. So how come that the norm of humanitarian intervention wasn't established in the 70s? Well, there's two reasons. They were carried out by the wrong people, not by us, so it can't establish a new norm. And the other reason is that the U.S. was bitterly opposed to both of them. In the case of India, they were put under sanctions. The U.S. threatened war, you know, sent a major aircraft carrier into the Bay of Bengal to threaten them and so on and so forth. And the reason for that was that they were interfering with a PR operation that Kissinger had very carefully planned. He was planning to go to China, you know, make a big thing about relations with China, and he had to go through Pakistan. And the Indians were undermining this by, invading East Pakistan to terminate the massacre of maybe a couple million people. So therefore, they had to be punished, and they were. In the case of Cambodia, the U.S. bitterly attacked the invasion. So did the media, you know, New York Times denounced them as the Prussians of Asia and so on. These are the people who were claiming to be upset by Pol Pot's atrocities. But when Vietnam ended them, Vietnam was attacked. In fact, the U.S. backed a Chinese invasion to punish Vietnam for the crime of terminating Pol Pot's atrocities. And the U.S. then started supporting the Khmer Rouge, U.S. and Britain, training them, arming them, and so on, and maintained the Khmer Rouge regime in the U.N. I said, you know, they're the official representative of Cambodia, and put Vietnam under sanctions. Well, since the U.N., U.S. bitterly opposed both of those interventions, they can't have been humanitarian interventions by definition. So two reasons, wrong people, and the U.S. opposed them. But if you want to find a real example, those are probably about the most plausible examples, say, in the past half century that I can think of. I mean, there are a couple of other cases you could argue for, like the British intervention in Sierra Leone, for example. They make a case for that, but it's very hard to find them. You know, I mean, states aren't moral agents. They don't do things for moral reasons. They're power systems. And sometimes what they do may be good or may not be good, but it's rarely for humane reasons. I mean, it's hard to find hard to find a single case in history. In fact, if you look at the big, thick legal histories of centuries of humanitarian intervention, you take every case. I mean, you know, each one of them erodes very quickly as soon as you look into it. I've written about it, so I don't think there are paradigm examples. I think the World Court was right. You know, and the recent UN panel is probably right. And the non-aligned countries, the 80% of the world population, I think they're basically right. The so-called humanitarian intervention is just imperial intervention by another name.
Okay, here's another short one.
that's a hint to me to shut up. My kids, when they were growing up, had an expression. They said, please, just the five-minute lecture.
Okay, so what would you say to those who now admit that perhaps the invasion of Iraq really did sow the seeds of democracy? Are there the beginnings of a democracy in Iraq now?
There could be. I mean, if we, that's our task, can compel the U.S. government, which is under our influence, to permit democracy to develop in Iraq, then it can. I mean, what's happened up till now is the U.S. has blocked it intensively. I mean, the thing I read from the Financial Times is, any competent scholar will tell you that, actually. You just even see it in the press if you read it carefully. Yeah, they tried to stop it. I mean, they managed to achieve something. Will it go on? Well, it depends on whether the U.S. and Britain will allow it. Primarily the U.S., Britain's kind of, you know, unfortunately, whatever you think about it, they're not an actor in this. They're a spear carrier, as the International Affairs Journals call them. So it's up to us, and that'll answer the question. I mean, you could argue. First of all, to look at what's been going on, there have been strong forces pressing for democracy in the Arab world and the Muslim world in general for a long time, usually blocked by the U.S. and Britain. And that goes right through the 90s. I mean, in Saudi Arabia and Iran, all over the place. I mean, Qatar had the first more or less democratic election in 1999. In Iran, there are reformist forces. So this is always going on. It did receive an impetus in 2001 from Osama bin Laden. In fact, it's well known. Read it in the standard media. The 9/11 did have an effect. I mean, it compelled the ruling tyrannies in the region to recognize that they got some big problems inside, and they better allow some opening to the reformist forces. In fact, for the first time in Saudi Arabia, which is the worst of them, they began to allow some leeway to the reformist forces. So if you want to credit somebody for the democratization, for the, you know, messianic vision, the best candidate is Osama bin Laden. He had more effect than anybody else. The major democratizing force in the Middle East has been Al Jazeera. That's And that's exactly why every government, practically every government in the region has either shut it down or tried to shut it down. And while the U.S. has tried to shut it down, I mean, you may recall that the Emir of Qatar came to Washington a couple of years ago, and Colin Powell, you know, administration moderate, gave him a dressing down and asked him to shut down Al Jazeera. You know, it's a pain in the neck. They're reporting independently. And the Emir, something quite amusing happened, which the press was disciplined enough not to report, though they mentioned it. The Emir responded by having a press conference in Washington. I don't know if it's possible to get the transcript of this, but there was some reporting of it, and it's pretty clear what happened. He gave a very ironic press conference in Washington where he explained to the American press that there's this idea of freedom of the press, you know, and we want to preserve it. I mean, we know you guys don't understand it, but back in Qatar, we think it's kind of important, so we're going to allow Al Jazeera to keep functioning. Well, when the U.S. couldn't get them to shut it down, what they did was bomb it. I mean, in Kabul, the U.S. bombed the offices of Al Jazeera as their local troops were coming in. Actually, I happened to be in Islamabad at the time for other reasons. And, you know, half the international press corps was in Islamabad, everybody trying to get into Afghanistan right at the peak of it. And you know what journalists are like. I mean, they mostly hang around the hotel bar. So if you walk to the hotel, in the hotel bar in the evening, everybody's talking and laughing and so on. At the time of the bombing of the Al Jazeera offices, the U.S. claimed it was just an accident, you know, kind of like by accident, just as the Northern Alliance was coming in, a missile happened to hit the Al Jazeera office, the only independent press there. Every journalist who in the bar was just laughing about this is ludicrous. They all reported it, you know. I mean, that's standard. I've seen it happen over and over. So they reported it. They knew it was garbage. The same thing happened in Baghdad. You know, they just bombed them out. And finally, in order to make sure that when the U.S. finally agreed to the elections last January, in order to make sure that they'd be democratic, they kicked Al Jazeera out. So there wouldn't be any independent reporting the Iraqis might see, only the controlled reporting. But they have been a major democratizing force. There's no doubt of it. I mean, you could argue, and I think it's probably true, that the conquest of Baghdad was such a shock in the Arab world. I mean, this is like the Mongol invasion from their point of view. It was such a shock in the Arab world that it set off shockwaves, which are doing all sorts of things. And, you know, among them maybe pressing for democracy. But anybody who thinks that you ought to praise that ought to make sure to be out on the streets next December 7th cheering the Japanese for bombing Pearl Harbor. Because the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor and, you know, capture of Singapore and so on set off huge currents in all of Asia, which led to throwing out the Western imperialists. I mean, that saved millions of lives in India alone, let alone who knows how many elsewhere. Do we praise the Japanese for their democratizing efforts? You know, I mean, yeah, if you hit some system with a sledgehammer, all kind of things are going to happen. And some of them may turn out to be beneficial, like the Japanese invasion and the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So, you know, yes, the capture of Baghdad was a tremendous shock in the Arab world. That's the center of Arab culture and history and so on, conquered by the Mongols again. Of course, that's going to set off an effect.
I somehow envision that soundbite being taken out and used in other ways.
Yes.
But we're all witnesses to the context.
Okay.
So here's a question about, are there other countries that practice what you would consider to be a true democracy, or at least one to aspire to?
Well, first of all, the U.S. has a democratic history. You know, I mean, in many respects, the U.S. is, in fact, a leader. And I mean, democracy has a lot of dimensions. You know, you don't rank it. You know? I mean, in some respects, the U.S. is unique, I think. So in protection of freedom of speech internally, say, not externally, but internally, The U.S., I think, is unique. I don't know any other country that reaches U.S. standards. Certainly not England, which is a horrible record on freedom of speech, and obviously not France, where they don't even know what it means. But literally, I'm not joking. But in the United States, yes, it's an admirable record. But remember, it's pretty recent. The U.S. reached a high standard of protection of freedom of speech in the course of the civil rights movement in the early 60s. That's when the courts struck down the really repressive laws as unconstitutional, law of seditious libel and so on. And that's typical. I mean, it's in the course of popular movements that steps are taken forward towards freedom and justice. And in the course of the civil rights movement, the U.S. courts finally reached a high standard of freedom of speech, and it continued. So that's important to mention. You know, it's maybe the most important single element. In terms of, if you look over the past history, there have been plenty of periods where there was a functioning democracy. There doesn't happen to be now, and it's by design, careful design. I mean, this is an unusually business-run society, and the last thing business wants is democracy. They want obedience, and they want distraction. They want people to be out of their hair so they can run the society. And you have a constant battle going on right through U.S. history about this. We happen to be at an unusual moment of business domination, so very low participation. I don't think there are democracies we should aspire to. We should do it our way. But if you want examples, I mean, there are examples. I mentioned Spain, for example. You know, and if we could reach the Spanish level, that would be an achievement. And in fact, if we want to stay in the Western Hemisphere, there are striking examples. I mean, again, it takes a lot of discipline for educated intellectuals not to see this, because it's right in front of your eyes. So take, say, the poorest country in the hemisphere, Haiti. Poor, miserable country. Not because there's something inherent in Haiti. It was the richest colony in the world, you know, source of most of France, a large part of France's wealth. But first France and then the United States drove it into total misery. Woodrow Wilson is one of the main criminals. Nevertheless, in 1990, they had an election which we can't dream of. I mean, in 1990, Haiti had an election which was not a choice between two rich fraternity brats at Yale who, you know, and so on. It's true. I mean, they had an election in which the population was able to elect their own candidate, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, populist priest, radical populist priest. How'd they do it? It was a shock to everybody. Nobody expected it. And it was a shock to everybody because nobody was paying attention to what was happening in the unimportant places like the slums and the hills where the population lives. And what was going on was that they were developing a pretty lively civil society with grassroots movements and, you know, popular organizations and so on. And they were strong enough so that without any resources, I mean, practically zero, it's an extremely poor country if you've ever been there, with no resources, they were able to win an election which everyone assumed was going to be won by the U.S. candidate, you know, a World Bank, former World Bank economist who the U.S. was backing and had the rich behind them and the U.S. behind them and so on. He got 14% of the vote, and Aristide won. Well, that's a democratic election. The U.S. was scandalized. I mean, it instantly terminated all aid to Haiti, redirected aid to what was called the democratic opposition, that is, you know, the U.S. guys who lost. The U.S. even reversed its refugee policy. I mean, up until that point, the U.S. had been illegally, you know, in gross violation of international law, blockading Haiti and not allowing people to escape from the murderous dictatorships, claiming they were economic refugees. Well, that's such a crime, you can't even talk about it. But as soon as Aristide was elected, they reversed the policy. And refugees, now that they were coming from a democratic society, were regarded as political refugees. Well, there were very few of them, because in fact the flow of people was going the other way during that moment when it looked like there was some hope. But if there were any, they were allowed to be, you know, rich businessmen or whatever. They could be political refugees. A couple of months later came the inevitable coup, military coup, which the U.S. immediately backed. The Organization of American States, which is committed to democracy, declared an embargo. The Bush administration, first Bush administration, announced at once that it was going to violate the embargo. It was going to allow U.S. companies to be excluded. There was a marvelous story about that in the New York Times, which reported that the Bush administration has decided to fine-tune the embargo for the benefit of the Haitian people, namely by excluding U.S. businesses from it. All for the benefit of the Haitian people. So the trade continued. When Clinton came in, it got worse. He increased trade. In fact, Clinton actually illegally allowed the Texaco Oil Company to ship oil to the military junta, which is the core product, in violation of presidential directives. Okay? The support was so strong. Actually, this was exposed the day before the Marine invasion, and it was exposed in a way which no newspaper could possibly have missed. If you've ever looked at AP wires, often they have a lead story, you know, which they keep repeating over and over again, so you can't miss it. The lead story the day before the invasion, when everybody, me too, was looking at the AP wires because an invasion was coming, the lead story, repeated over and over, was a Treasury Department concedes that the Clinton administration illegally authorized shipment of oil to the military junta. You think it got reported? Actually, I did a survey later. It was reported in the business press and in the petroleum journals and so on. A couple of words scattered here and there somewhere. It's just not the right story. The right story is we're bringing democracy. Clinton did, in fact, kick out the military junta. Haitians had been tortured enough, but there was a condition. Aristide was allowed back in on condition that he follow the policies of the defeated U.S. candidate in the 1990 election, which was clear was going to destroy Haiti. It was a ridiculous neoliberal policy which was going to wipe the country out, as it did. That goes down in history as our glorious moment of enhancing democracy. And it didn't work because Haiti's a failed state, you know, so what can we do? Those wrong genes or something like that. The 1990 election is something we might try to aspire to in the poorest, most repressed country in the hemisphere. And there are others. But the point is it doesn't really make sense to try to follow the model of others. We're so much better off than anyone else that we ought to be so far ahead of them that, trying to achieve what they did is we ought to be ashamed to even think about it.
I've been told by the organizers that we have run an hour over. For those of us who are accustomed to seeing an audience flee when the bell rings, I'm guessing that hour went fairly quickly. One more question, and then I'm thinking we should let Noam Chomsky retire, at least from the stage. So you have done a wonderful job of touching on the core problems and dangers facing our society and the world. What do you see as the most effective way for us to effect change and, if possible, turn the course toward humane national leadership?
Well, I think there's a pretty simple answer. Like almost everything, either there's no answer or there's a simple answer. In this case, there's a simple answer. What's needed in the United States is to change the social and political system so that public opinion plays a role in public policy. Okay? You know, it's not really a very radical idea, you know. And there's no doubt that we can achieve it. I mean, if they can achieve it in the hills and slums of Haiti, we can't do it, you know. I mean, it's outlandish, you know. Of course we can do it. Furthermore, the public, you know, a lot of my friends and, you know, our friends were very depressed at the November election. I think it's the wrong reaction. It was very hopeful. I mean, the fact that the parties, both of them, are way to the right of the population is a hopeful sign. It means that, you know, you really don't have to organize people. I mean, most people, I mean, I find no matter where I go, you know, Central Iowa, Florida, wherever it may be, I'm pretty much in the mainstream of public opinion. I mean, not on what they call the social issues. Like, I don't think the world was created 6,000 years ago, you know, I'm in favor of abortion rights and so on. But those are very marginal issues for people. I mean, they're emphasized in the media and everywhere else as a part of the technique of marginalization. I mean, what people care about, you know, is, am I going to be able to take care of my sick mother, or, you know, am I going to have a job or something like that? Are we going to, you know, have a nuclear war which will destroy the world and so on? Those are things that people care about, and on those things, their attitudes, I think, are pretty sane. And in fact, some of them are very surprising. I mean, like, I've never heard anybody write, and I've never written, that the U.S. ought to give up the Security Council veto. You know, have you ever seen it anywhere? I mean, that happens to be the majority opinion, because people want the UN to take the lead. There's even more striking things, which I didn't have time to get to, but right after the federal budget was announced in February, there was another major study by the major Program on International Policy Attitudes, you know, it's the major polling institution in the world, a careful one at the University of Maryland. They did a study of public attitudes on the budget, and it's just dramatic. I mean, the public is strongly opposed to everything on the budget. I mean, the majority of the population, large majority, wants to cut military spending, increase social spending, you know, for health, education, and welfare, and so on. Want to increase funding for the United Nations, increase international aid, and more funding for renewable energy. You make your own personal wish list, and you'll find that that's approximately what pretty close to what the large majority of the public wants. Well, as far as I get, that's a hard one to check in a data search, but I couldn't find any report of it. You know, what could be more important? Okay, so what can we do? We can return the country to a more democratic state. That takes work, and it's not, it can be done up to a point. There comes a point where you do run into the resistance of concentrated power, which isn't going to let it go any further. But that's not the end of the world either. Tyrannies have been overthrown in the past. I mean, if we want to be serious about it, you know, there is a tyranny in the country. I mean, in the 20th century, here's another line that can be taken out of context, but let me say it. There are three forms of totalitarianism that were imposed by state power in the 20th century. One was Bolshevism, one was fascism, and the third is corporations. It's true. They are basically totalitarian, and they were created by radical judicial activism, which doesn't bother strict constructionists, and created by state power and given extraordinary rights. In fact, a century ago, there actually were conservatives. I mean, the term is used now, but the category doesn't exist. But the conservatives a century ago bitterly opposed the court decisions and the state decisions that created these tyrannical structures and, in fact, described them as a form of communism and a return to feudalism, which is not inaccurate. And a lot of their advocates recognize that, too, like Woodrow Wilson, but advocated it anyway. And it's correct. I mean, if you look at them, it's a kind of an unaccountable tyranny given an extraordinary right. And they happen to be pathological by law. Like, you cannot blame a corporate executive. I mean, sometimes the accusations are just unfair. Like, the Wall Street Journal about a week or two ago had a front page critical article criticizing Genentech and Novartis, you know, two big pharmaceutical corporations, because they had used their enormous power to suppress an invention by some small company of a vaccine that could protect people from peanut allergy, which is pretty serious. It hits a couple million people, and there are a lot of deaths from it. And they had just were able to crush it by force, because they wanted to preserve monopoly rights for their own inferior product. And the Wall Street Journal article was kind of critical. But that's unfair, you know. It's kind of like criticizing somebody for stopping at a red light in traffic. I mean, you can't criticize people for following the law, you know. And the law in the United States, the core of Anglo-American corporate law, is that corporations must be brutal monsters. That was settled almost a century ago in a major court case, Dodge versus Ford, in which the Henry Ford was kind of like corporation was sort of privately owned, and he was trying to improve wages and raise wages and make better cars. And some of his shareholders, Dodge Brothers, brought him to court for that. I mean, they said it's, you know, it's cutting back on the value of their shares. They wanted it because they wanted to start their own car company, which became Dodge. They went to the courts, and they won. The court concluded that the sole duty of a corporate management is to maximize profit and market share. Okay? And if you try to do anything decent, it's illegal. So you can't blame Genentech and Novartis for this. The courts over the century have modified this. So they have allowed exceptions. So, for example, a pharmaceutical corporation is allowed to give out free drugs in the slums as long as the television cameras are rolling. So you can do it if it's purely hypocritical, you know. So it's just a way of improving your image and increasing market share. In fact, the courts have gone so far as to urge corporations in legal important cases to go out of their way to do things that look beneficial, or else, I'm now quoting, or else an aroused public will figure out what you're up to and take away your privileges. So in order to prevent an aroused public from understanding what's going on, you better act benevolent now and then. That's a significant court decision, and it also answers the question. I mean, you can be the aroused public. You don't have to wait for anybody to tell you. I mean, the systems of domination and control have no right to exist. They can be dismantled, as they've been in the past. It's not a particularly radical point of view. It's actually a conservative point of view, as it was a century ago, and it's certainly within reach.
Thanks, Jeff.